morning from the park. So I think it will have messed up a few of our colleagues. But looking at Ty, I think we may have to start. They will join us along the way. May I start by requesting that all our cellular phones be switched off? I have mine off. As we discuss, it is being recorded, so when your phone rings, even if it's on silent or vibration, for the duration that it is ringing, whatever is being said is not recorded. So please, you could have our cellular phones off. It will assist the proceedings. Secondly, members of parliament, comrades, the seats here are usually allocated to us. Now you, I see some of you have backbenchers right at the back. No, we're supposed to be eyeball to eyeball with the accused, so if you are that far. Secondly, I hope you all have copies of today's program. In case you don't, just raise your hand so that Tommy can make it available to you. Just raise your hand right at the back, Enrico. Right there at the back. Right. I would like to welcome the Deputy Auditor General and congratulate her on her appointment to that position. This being Women's Month, it's worth noting that she's the first woman Deputy Auditor General in our country. Congratulations. I also want to welcome as well our brand new Accountant General. Welcome. Today's setting is very unusual because the positions, the spaces occupied by the AG and National Treasurer are usually occupied by the accused, and both of them are witnesses sitting this side with us. But today they find themselves in unfamiliar territory. But correctly so, because as comrades would recall, we have agreed that before we get into any serious business, it would assist our work very much if the two stakeholders who are very, very helpful and useful to our work can interact with us and say to us, this is who we are, and this is what we do, and this is how we are of help to oversight, and especially to the public accounts committee, both the AG as well as the National Treasurer. As comrades will note, whenever we have hearings, the Auditor General's office is always represented, and so is National Treasurer. So that in the course of the discussions and the debate, when someone says, no, the Auditor General did not get it right, at least we have somebody who audited the books who will be able to say, no, this is what happened. Or if we're told, no, National Treasury is refusing to give us money, or National Treasury is being impossible, then we at least have someone from National Treasury to explain and give context, so that there is, so we're able to deal with the facts. We don't have stories being created on why things have not been done in the right manner. So we felt, as we agreed, that maybe these two critical stakeholders should talk with us, talk to us, interact with us, help clarify and enlighten us, so that as we move into the mainstay of our work for the next 5 years, we at least have had the benefit of interacting with them. So what we're going to do, which is always our ritual, Madam Deputy AG and Accountant General, is to start by knowing each other. So, like the Auditor General's office to introduce themselves, National Treasury, and then Comrades to introduce themselves, and then we can then get into the business of the day.
Good morning, members. My name is Yanda Saki. I'm the senior manager responsible for stakeholder management.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Takane Rasela, the deputy auditor general.
Good morning, honorable chairperson and honorable members. My name is Zanele Keto from auditor general. I'm the stakeholder liaison manager.
Apologies to speak for here. Good morning, members. My name is Michael Fess. I'm the Accountant General.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Jay Steyer, and I'm from the Office of the Accountant General at the National Treasury.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Lindy Bordevik. I'm also from the Accountant General's Office.
The new parliament.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, members. My name is Nico Mare. I'm from the National Treasury Parliamentary Office in Cape Town.
Thank you. Yes, Comrade. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Chair. Good morning, everyone. My name is Grace Turkey, the member of the Portfolio Committee of the. What is that? Yeah,
the standing
committee on scope. I'm new in this committee, that's why I'm a little bit lost. Thank you.
Good morning, honorable members and chairperson. My name is Ntabi Senkuno. I'm a member of the committee. Thanks.
Good morning. My name is Kanye Sile, Litchfield Chabalala, also a member of SCOPA.
Good morning. My name is Shati Kekaima. I'm a member of this committee.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Tim Bradford, member of SCOPA.
Chairman Alf Lees, SCOPA member, Avanya Batumajamba.
Right, thank you. I'm Comrade Temba Goti. I chair the committee. Right. Let me have to take us through the. I think what I'm going to do, Comrades, to make the presentation, and when it's done, then we can then ask questions for clarity or whatever else we may need to be cleared on. We have until 11:30 to be with you. If we started at 9, so.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'll go through the presentation, which won't take up as much time as what we've been given, because I'd like to give us all an opportunity to rather engage on questions and comments that you might have at this stage. As you know, the Office of the Auditor General is set up in terms of the Constitution. We're one of the Chapter 9 institutions that are mandated to support democracy by auditing the use of public funds through the public sector and reporting on that in a manner that enables effective accountability, transparency, and oversight. Read with the Constitution, our enabling act is the Public Audit Act, and it specifies that the Office of the Auditor General must audit and report on the accounts, financial statements, and financial management of government institutions through all three spheres. So it would cover national and provincial departments, all constitutional institutions. It would cover Parliament as well as the 9 legislatures in the provinces. It covers all the municipalities and the municipal entities, effectively any other institution or accounting entity that is required to be audited by us in terms of any legislation would then form part of our responsibilities as well. In fact, the Public Audit Act goes on to specify that we have the mandate to choose to audit any institution that receives funding from the National Revenue Fund, from Provincial Revenue Funds, or Municipal Funds. So really, we have the ability and access to audit any institution in the country that has access to public funds. Our aspiration, therefore, as the Supreme Audit Institution of the country, is really to create a better life, a more dignified life for all of South Africa's citizens, to contribute to that by contributing to effective, efficient, and economical service delivery. We think that if we, as the independent audit institution, ensure that we apply high levels of professionalism in all that we do and focus on using the insights that we gain when we conduct our audits to provide government or those tasked with running the affairs of government with the type of insights that allow them to do their jobs better, we would be contributing to this very aspiration. We think that all of us operating in the public service ought to focus on ensuring that we demonstrate high levels of professionalism through our conduct, ethical conduct. We ought to drive effective accountability and oversight in all that we do by applying consequences, appropriate consequences when things go wrong. And also focus on building the type of institutional capacity that's going to drive the preparation of transparent information, financial information, performance information, to ensure that all of the work that we do is also supported by strong internal audit capabilities, because we think that is an element that will ensure that we do build the institutional capacity that we require. Over and above our mandate to audit and report, we drive much of our value add in terms of our visibility drive. It's a drive that we've been engaging on for the last 7 years, much more actively in the latter 5 years. And essentially, we spend a lot of time with executive authorities right throughout government, with oversight committees, again, in all the legislatures and in parliament as well, because we think it's important that we provide those that are responsible for running government and for overseeing the activities of government with access to information that's going to enable them to do their work better. We compile general reports. Once we've done all of our audits, we compile general reports, and these serve as a summary of the diagnosis that we've made around what are the barriers towards better transparency and accountability, and include summarized recommendations and a set of actions that we recommend be taken by executive, by administration, but by also by oversight. And these general reports are tabled in Parliament and in the relevant legislatures as and when they're prepared. If we turn then to the work that we do, through the 9 provincial offices and the head office and the 3,300 people that we work with, 500 of whom are chartered accountants, we conduct regularity audits. These are annual audits that we conduct right through the 3 spheres of government. So every single institution is subjected to an annual audit, a regularity audit. And we do these audits using insights not only from the traditional regularity auditors, the ones that some of you might remember used to carry green pens and red pens. They don't do that anymore, but they used to. But we also use the capacity that sits within our information systems audit experts in the office, and they help us conduct data analytics and mine the information systems that that government runs on. We're also supported by investigation capacity within the office. We have a team that helps us get closer to the risk areas within which we are auditing. And we also have performance audit as a key competency in the office, and we try to integrate their insights into the regularity work. So effectively, over and above having an investigations team and a performance audit team that does performance audits and investigations on a discretionary basis, on a standalone basis, we do try to get them to work closer with our regularity audit team so that every year the way that we audit any institution is improving because we have the benefit of this insight and input that we otherwise wouldn't have if we didn't focus on it. Let me talk a little bit about performance audit. I indicated just now that we have the discretion to conduct performance audits to our government. Performance audits are different from regularity audits in that here we don't give an opinion, we merely state the facts around what it is we found. And the focus here is on looking at whether or not there's been value for money in the manner in which government or a government institution has spent public funds. So we look at particular projects, we look at particular government programs. So you'll remember in the middle of last year we launched a report about the use of consultants to our government. So that was a performance audit that was more factual insights about whether or not there were indications of problems around value for money in how consultants were being used to our government. So that's just one example of the performance audits that we do. We don't do those in every entity every year. We conduct some analyses and arrive at a conclusion as to where our efforts are best placed in terms of performance audits, because these are indeed discretionary and they're often driven by where we see serious gaps. And these gaps we diagnose when we do our regularity audit. So basically we arrive every year, we do our regularity audit and we table it. Out of that exercise, we're able to gain some insight as to where some of the problems are. Then we're able to go in and look at them more specifically in that program or in that project and try and articulate on what the barriers are to more effective spend by government. Let me come back to the regularity or the annual process that we run. As you know, local government is governed by the MFMA, and their year end is the 30th of June. They submit reports for us to audit as of the 31st of August. We start report auditing and then we finalize our audits on the 30th of November each year. So that's the blue blocks I'm following on the screen. In July of the following year, we then table the general report, which is the summary of the audit reports that we would have finished as at the end of November. You might ask, but why does it take so long? There's a long period between November and July. Quite simply, we spend time analyzing these outcomes, trying to figure out what is it that we can glean from the information we've gathered throughout the country. We spend time talking to our auditors, so the staff that actually conduct the audits. You can imagine the Auditor General himself does not get to every single municipality every year. But to try and get the best insight as to what it is that's happening, we have to talk to the auditors that conduct the work. So we spend a lot of time on that. We also spend time talking to the people responsible for those entities. So the mayors, the councillors, we'll talk to the provincial leadership responsible for that particular province. And we also speak to national government as well. So all of those consultations do take time. That analysis does take time. But we think it's time well spent, because by the time we table a report at the end of July, it's one that has got the benefit of real insight gained by our auditors, that has got the understanding of those responsible for those entities, and the acceptance of those responsible for those entities, so that the discourse can be much more about what it is that we all have to focus on in terms of fixing things. Then if I move on to the green blocks on that same screen, those talk to the PFMA cycle, the Public Finance Management Act, which relates to provincial and national government. Their year ends are the end of March. We receive their financial statements at the end of May, and then we audit those and finish those reports as of the 31st of July. So come 31st of July, we are signing off all of these audits right across the country. We then, once again, spend time looking at those reports, analyzing the outcomes, trying to understand what the real insights are that we can articulate so that things can be improved upon. So we then table that general report, the PFMA one, in the first quarter of the following year. Last year, we tabled it in November of the same year, so we didn't wait for this new year. And we aim to do that again this year. So we're also trying to get quicker and better and more efficient in all that we do. Okay. A regularity audit, and I think I must emphasize this, because even as auditors, we have to remind each other about what it is that a regularity audit is designed to do and not designed to do. So That annual audit that we conduct and report upon looks at three critical areas. The first one is whether or not the financial statements are fairly presenting the reality. So is the, what was called the income statement, the balance sheet, the cash flow, are they a fair representation of what that government entity has achieved and what it has safeguarded as assets and how it has performed? Is it a reflection of real reality? So that's the first take. So if we feel that the financial, if we arrive at an opinion that those financial statements do meet the criteria for fair representation, that they don't misstate the facts as we have assessed them to be, then we give a tick, which is to say that the financials fairly present. So that's the first area. The second area is about whether or not performance information is useful and reliable. Because in the use of public funds, every government entity must present an annual performance report as well. Over and above the financial statements, they've got to give a performance report that says these were the objectives that we agreed upon when the budget was allocated, and this is how we've performed against those objectives. So that yourselves, as oversight, can understand how the budgets that you approved were actually dealt with in the context of the performance objectives that you agreed upon with yourself. So we look at whether or not there's usefulness and reliability of the performance report. That's tick number two. The third element is about whether or not there has been compliance with key laws and regulations relating to financial management and financial reporting. So we don't look at all the laws that a government entity would be subject to, but we do look at those that relate predominantly to how financials, finances are managed and how finance management is engaged upon, but also how financial reports are prepared. So if an auditee has arrived at those first three ticks, they get what we've come to know really as a clean audit. So those are the first three ticks. And these three elements we are required to look at, conclude upon, and report upon by law. The Public Audit Act specifically provides that we do that. It also goes on to say, this act, it also goes on to say that the Auditor General must identify key internal control deficiencies that have been, that need to be addressed in that entity. So whilst that might not form part of the clean audit criteria, it is something we report upon. So when you get an audit report from our office, it will look at these three areas and it will articulate on whether or not we found key internal control deficiencies that need to be addressed. Many private sector auditors look purely at the first element, which is the one about have the financial statements been fairly presented. And that's an important consideration. And that's where we'll say somebody has got an unqualified audit opinion on their financial statements. And it's important because it's the first step towards demonstrating transparent reporting and accountability. But I'm sure you'll agree that it's not the end of the story, especially when one is dealing with public funds, because we must be able to demonstrate whether or not we have met the objectives that we promised we would meet when we allocated that budget. So people often ask me, but why is the Auditor General so worried about these other two criteria around performance information and compliance? And the reality is that public institutions that use public funds must demonstrate accountability. So it's one thing to say, yes, these are my financials and this is how I've used the money, but we must be able to demonstrate whether or not we've met the promises that we had made when that budget was allocated. And we must also demonstrate that we've observed key laws and regulations that relate to our environment. We look at the area of key control deficiencies because the focus of all of us ought to be on driving the building of institutional capacity that's going to generate credible information on an ongoing basis, that's going to safeguard the assets that we're entrusted with. Because if we're not going to be focusing on building capacity so that there is stability in the system, we're always going to be waiting with anxiety for the audit outcome, and not focusing on actually building the foundation and building the systems that are going to predictably deliver the outcomes that we seek. Just to highlight the point, our regularity audit doesn't look at all the laws that are relevant to that particular entity. It also doesn't say whether or not service delivery has been achieved. It is a good indicator of accountability and transparent reporting, and it enables oversight to have a meaningful conversation with those that are entrusted with running government. But it doesn't say that service delivery has been achieved. It also doesn't identify all manner of fraud that may or may not be there, but certainly our assertions on non-compliance with laws and regulations, as well as on key internal controls, often give a useful indicator as to whether or not that government entity has left itself susceptible to fraud risk, whether or not internal controls are strong enough to either prevent fraud or detect it and recover from it quickly. And that's why our focus is on making sure that the conversation is about whether or not we're building the type of capacity, institutional capacity, where key controls are in place. Because, yes, fraud will happen. People will take chances. But we've got to create an environment where the opportunity is minimized because internal controls are strong. But also, when somebody does do something wrong, we're able to detect it quickly and recover from it quickly. And that is going to happen when we've got strong internal controls. Okay, I've spoken about the clean audit conversation. Effectively, what clean audit indicates is that an auditee has met those three criteria I spoke about. And those are the three criteria that are specified in the Public Audit Act. We are mindful as an audit office that the term clean audit tends to be somewhat distracting, because I think it's natural in the minds of people. One will think if something is not clean, it's the exact opposite. And just like when something is not white, it is the exact opposite. So we're spending a lot of time ensuring that people we talk to understand what we mean when we say clean audit. It is effectively an audit institution that has met that three criteria that are required by law. It's an audit institution basically that's got an unqualified opinion on financial statements, that's criteria number one, and has no findings on performance information and has no findings on compliance. So it's got no findings on the other two criteria. If we decide to change the name, quite happy. The criteria doesn't change. Why? Because the Act requires that the Office of the Auditor General audit and report on these three elements. But also, it is consistent with the drive towards better transparency, better accountability, and enabling effective oversight, as I indicated earlier. Okay. Other than this unqualified with no findings or clean audit, there are three other audit categories or audit outcomes that I'd like to talk to. The first one is the qualified audit, and often we put it in the purple color. And it indicates that on financial information, that government institution was not able to provide information that fairly presents the reality of its affairs. However, in that context, we were able to say where the problem is. So we could say, this entity, the financials are fine except for the fact that their fixed assets are not appropriately dealt with, or for the fact that their expenditure is not appropriately disclosed. But at least you as a user of financial statements know where the problem is. So you can still use them and try and figure out which areas are problematic. Often people who have qualified audit opinions will have findings on the other two criteria, simply because one of the areas of compliance we look at is whether or not the PFMA has been appropriately complied with, especially the element that deals with the need to maintain proper accounting records.
And that is the responsibility of an accounting officer, and they need to ensure that they deliver proper accounting records. The reason somebody will have a qualified audit opinion is because they have not met that particular requirement. So they'll often have a finding as well. Adverse audit opinion is when we say that the error that we've picked up manifests and affects different parts of the financial statements. So we don't think that these financials fairly present. Disclaimer audit opinion, we put it in red just like adverse. That's where we're unable to find evidence to support what management puts to us. So when an audit begins, we're given financial statements. We look at the numbers. We ask for the evidence to support it, and we inspect that evidence. When we're not given that evidence to support it, we're unable to say whether or not that number is right. And that's why we say the disclaimer of audit opinion. The auditor was simply unable to complete his or her work. I think this diagram you're fairly okay with, which is the role of oversight. But I think I just wanted to highlight that at the time that a budget is voted by the oversight body, at the time of the strategic planning, and then the administration basically starts to apply that budget and report on it during the course of the year in terms of where they are in implementing the key projects that were approved. And then at the end of the year, they then present audited financial statements and a performance report through the annual report to basically account for how they've spent public funds. We would like to find ways to work with you on ensuring that we support you right throughout the process, and you as a collective, as a collective oversight body. So through the portfolio committees, through SCOPA, we would want to find ways to continue to work with you right throughout the cycle so that we don't only come at the year end and provide you with information when, you know, the ability to act on it is not as strong as it would have been had we been able to give you information during the course of the year. So one of the elements that we engage in quite actively is that of sharing our assessment on key controls. Remember the fourth element when I talked about what we do on an ongoing basis is we look at the status of internal controls in the audit environment. We don't only look at it at the end of the year when we arrive for audit. In fact, what we do is we spend time with those that are running government. So it's the municipal managers, the HODs, the minister, the MECs. We spend with basically administration and executive talking about what key controls ought to be strengthened and what progress they are making in strengthening those key controls. I'll give you an example. Let's say that we're auditing a particular department, and at the end of the year, they had a qualification on fixed assets, and they need to now go and fix their fixed asset register. Then they commit to oversight that indeed they will fix this thing so that come the end of the year, they don't have this qualification on their audit. We will spend time with them at least four times a year. So every quarter, we go and visit them to talk about a host of things, but one of them will focus on how are we doing with sorting out that fixed asset register so that we can understand during the course of the year where things are going, but also keep their minds focused on the things that they've committed to do. We're able to share that insight with portfolio committees on an ongoing basis to say our assessment of where things are headed is either good or not so great, so that as oversight, they know which areas to focus on when they engage with departments. Okay, I think I've basically spoken to that part. So maybe just one other matter I wanted to highlight. In the context of briefing portfolio committees in Parliament on audit outcomes, we'll brief on the audit outcomes for a particular department, but we'll also share with you our own diagnosis of the root causes for poor outcomes, and to share with you the good practices that we're seeing where other people are making gains, so that at least you're able to drive the right type of behavior amongst the various departments as well.
I'll now move on just to share with you some of the audit outcomes over the last 5 years. This is just for the PFMA cycle, so it's the provincial and national departments across the country. That yellow line is the one that talks to unqualified with findings. So that is that category where the financials have fairly presented, but there is a finding either on compliance or on performance information. The green line is the one that is unqualified with no findings. That's the one that was at 22% when we finished 2012-13. That's that green line. So that's the one where the three key criteria were met. Are the colors very clear on your printout? They're not. Okay, all right. I think the major point maybe I should just make without spending too much time then on this graph, because I think the colors printed a bit funny. And it's not because you're colorblind. you see that by far many of the provincial and national government departments and entities sit in the area of yellow. I'd like to talk about this yellow because it has an interesting character to it and one that can help you focus your work. Remember I spoke about three key criteria that must be met, which is financial information. So the yellow ones have got financial information, that's fine, which is a good thing. It's an important step. But then you say that they've got a finding on some area. It's either on compliance or on performance information. Now it's easy to get comfortable and complacent about being in the yellow zone in that you've got unqualified financial statements. And I emphasize again, it is an important step. However, in the context of dealing with public funds, it cannot be the be-all and end-all. It cannot be the definition we're driving at. Because the character of an entity that's sitting with an unqualified audit opinion, I'll give you an example. They would have reached a goal of reporting credibly on their financial statements, but their performance information might be problematic. So what are we saying about how they've actually made their promises, how they're able to account for the promises that they've delivered upon? The next area we should worry you is the one about compliance. And I'll talk a bit more about some of these compliance findings. But if a government entity is unable to indicate that they have built the type of capacity that's going to drive effective compliance with laws and regulations that apply to them, that's going to drive correct performance information, I think we ought to be worried. And at least we know where to focus. At least we got to the truth about financial information, but there's still some way to go. You'll see that the disclaimers, which is the second last line is from the bottom, are coming down, which is a good thing. So it means that the drive towards better financial reporting is there and evident. That very last line at the bottom, it started at 2% in 2008-09 and sat at 5% 2012-13. That talks to audits that were outstanding at the time that we finished our audit processes. Many of those auditees are those that were unable to supply us with financial statements for audit on the date on which they're required to. So we weren't able to then finish our audits. It would be important to keep an eye on that, but it doesn't deteriorate, because a key step towards accountability is at least the ability to submit financials for audit. Okay. I think these colors are a bit clearer on this one, but at least it gives you the three of you. And I think you can see from there that we have yet to see a meaningful step change in improvement. What is pleasing is that indeed there are improvements and we must celebrate that. But I think we need to find a way to have the step change so that we have many, many more that sit with unqualified with no findings and even fewer that sit with qualified. And we believe that a key contributor to that is building robust
internal control systems within government. And to build on that point, of the entities that we reported upon as at the end of 2012-13, there were 96 improvements, which is important to note and worth celebrating. However, we also saw 51 regressions. Those are the ones that went backwards. Those are the ones that either moved from unqualified with no findings to unqualified with findings. Those that move from unqualified with findings and then move to unqualified. Imagine if we had not had the ones that went backwards. We would have sat with many more sitting with unqualified with no findings. And we know that the best way to do that, the best way to avoid regressions, is by focusing on building capacity, by focusing on these internal controls. Because that's the best way we know that the foundation on which these unqualified with no findings audits are going to be built and maintained. We often report on the key spenders in government, just from a budget point of view, just so that we can focus our mind on the things that need attention. So the first graph on the left-hand side shows you the outcomes for education, for health, and for public works being the biggest votes, and then if you compare it to the other departments. So you'll see then that the unqualified with no findings are predominantly in the smaller departments, and then the adverse and disclaimers, which is the red, sit with the big spenders. So at least we know where we might want to focus our work. A pleasing outcome is the improvement we've been seeing on how performance information is dealt with. And as you can see, there's much more green than red on that graph. We say that the vast majority of auditees are demonstrating an ability to report on their performance information in a way that's useful and can be relied upon, so that at least as oversight you have that benefit. We're excited about this. And we think it's a very good foundation for us to build on, especially when we must start having a conversation with some of these departments about what actually sits behind the performance objectives that are set. I make this point because often people will lament that, well, in a province you have an office of the premier getting a clean audit, and yet the rest of the province doesn't. And we say, well, actually, if you look at the performance information of that office of the premier, does it demonstrate the full ambit of what that entity is mandated to do? So when parliament, or when that legislature approves their budget, approves their predetermined objectives, do they have sight as to what else they ought to be doing? Or does the Office of the Premier only carve out those things that they think they can do and then just do and report, which is a great foundation, it's important, but at least it's one that you can now start to have a more interesting conversation with them to say, actually, you have greater responsibilities. If you look at the ambitions around effective, coordinated, and coherent governance, you need to ensure that you meet your responsibilities and your mandate. So we're excited about this because it's a good foundation for us to have these interesting conversations and drive more effective governance throughout the system. Compliance, I've spoken to briefly, which is the area that results in many a finding within the audit portfolio, with 336 auditees having had a compliance finding of some sort or the other. So many of those that had unqualified audits, the ones that were yellow, would have had a finding around compliance. And let me take you through what those key findings were. So the quality of the financials that were submitted to us for audit, 255 auditees were unable to give us financials that were proper for us to audit.
So they met their legislative deadline to submit financials as of the 31st of May, but those financials were not accurate. They had material misstatements. And we're not looking at things that are small. We're looking at things that are material. In 43% of the cases, there were issues around the procurement and management of contracts. So procurement processes, the regulations that are issued by my colleague behind me and his team were often not complied with. And then there was the element about irregular food waste and wasteful expenditure as well as unauthorized expenditure that would not have been followed up. So the issue is not so much that you didn't prevent it, but also that you wouldn't have followed up on it as required by law. Because if there's an incidence of irregular expenditure, the law requires that there be some consequence. You've got to investigate it, you've got to have disciplinary processes that follow it. And too often we find that's not happening and we report on it as a non-compliance. The matter about payment within 30 days is something that we still see troubling at least a quarter of our auditees. Management of strategic planning and performance, that's an area that will result with poor outcomes, especially around performance information if it's not as, properly managed. And then we also look at the area of billing and control of revenue. But I think if you can see that graph for what it is, the key areas that we ought to focus on if we're going to win this must be around the quality of financial statements and the capacity to prepare those financial statements on an ongoing basis, as well as the procurement processes. We worry about the thing about financial statements because if an accounting officer is unable to prepare financial statements for us to audit, it starts to indicate that there may be unreliable information being given to the executive and oversight during the course of the year, but particularly the executive. So you've got to ask the question of what sort of decisions are you making if you're unable to at least provide credible financial information. And the matter about supply chain is important because if those regulations that are designed to drive efficient, effective, cost-effective, transparent, equitable, and fair procurement processes as required by law, if those regulations are not met, it means that we're starting to compromise that aspiration around effective spend of public funds, deriving value for money in how we procure goods and services. The quality of financial statements submitted, that just makes the point that remember those unqualified, the ones that were yellow? Many of them earned their yellow on the back of the work that we did. So what it tells you is that if we had not given people an opportunity to fix the financials that they gave us in the first instance, we would have had only 43% having unqualified audit opinions. We ended up with 80% having unqualified audit opinions, whether with or without findings, but it's because we were able to give them an opportunity to fix during the course of the audit. They didn't meet the law in terms of meeting their responsibility to prepare information accurately during the year and present us with fair information, but they relied on us to give them that opportunity to fix on an ongoing basis during the course of the audit. I'll just repeat the point to say we think that the key solution here is just to focus on driving key controls and strengthening the controlled environment within which auditees operate. And it's really about daily disciplines, weekly disciplines, monthly disciplines. If those things are put in place, then we should be able to make headway. Okay, these disciplines cover areas around proper record keeping, and we look at this when we go to the auditees as well. Are records being kept properly? Are bank reconciliations being done on an ongoing basis? Are they being checked? Are accurate and regular reports being presented to management and to executive? And is compliance with the law monitored and effectively so. We often report on what we've diagnosed as the key root causes that impede us from making progress. And we see that slow response by management remains a challenge, where when they say that they're going to do something to fix the problem, they don't, or they don't do it quickly enough. So we get these repeat sort of problems. The lack of consequences for poor performance and when there are transgressions of laws and regulations, that is an area that needs attention, because if we're not able to deal with consequences, we start to create a culture where the norm is non-compliance. Because if I do something wrong and nothing happens to me, you know, somebody next to me will do just the same. So it's important that we drive effective consequences, because that's how we're going to build a culture where ethical behavior, appropriate conduct, compliance with laws and regulations is upheld throughout the public service. The vacancies issue in key positions amongst provincial and national government departments, that has largely been resolved, the matter of vacancies largely. You still see some vacancies and we track it, but we think that, you know, it's getting the attention it deserves. What we still see needing attention is the one about competencies. So do the people that are being appointed have the appropriate competencies? But also, instability. It creates real problems when somebody still is appropriately then appointed, but then they don't stay long enough to gain traction on the progress that they would have been able to make in that role. So we think that's an area that needs attention, especially the provincial and national government. It's not so much about vacancies, but more about the instability of people in those administrative roles. And Chair, that is me.
Thank you very much, DAG. I suppose that comrades were not in areas where they would want to get clarity. I would want to invite comrades to ask any questions that they may have. 1, 2, 3, 4, and then comrade four. Okay, yeah, let's take the first part.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks to for the presentation from DAG. Is that how we're referring to? That's great. Much of this is familiar ground, but the there are a couple of issues that are of concern. For instance, the regularity side of things. You do a lot of work in trying to assist entities to achieve the clean audit. I mean, that's a kind of brief. And the danger there, of course, is that you become party to achieving an objective rather than being a proper auditor. And that's a real danger, and I'm sure your people don't fall into that trap. But the you comment on performance, and you've made the comment that performance, even if low targets are set, at least that's a starting point. And then you I assume, are saying that you say to the auditee that those targets don't include the full ambit of what you should be doing. Now, if I progress that to regularity issues, for instance, the issue of irregular expenditure. Very, very often, irregular expenditure is not wasteful. It may well be in line with performance objectives, but the regulations themselves are so stringently drawn that they are almost impossible to achieve and provide the services that you're obliged to provide. And so you'll spend 3 years going through a procurement process, and services could have been delivered 2 years earlier or 2.5 years earlier. Where I'm going is that you're making comments about performance targets, you're making comments about anything, but I never hear you guys saying, these regulations are just not right. These regulations need to be amended by us or others in this parliament or the minister. Is that not part of the AG function? And I'm on dangerous ground because it might appear that you're trying to help people actually achieve a clean audit. And suppose that is true, but the fact is that these regulations, in my experience, are almost, some of them are just ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. And I know that the objective is grand and it's good and we need to have those objectives, but I think it slows down service delivery quite considerably. Now, in my past life I was a counsellor, and you made a brief comment about talking to counsellors. In my experience, your department does not talk to counsellors. And even when I've made personal contact with someone like Barry Wheeler, the response was, thank you for the information, but we won't report back to you. We'll report back to the mayor and the speaker and other high-level officials. Now, how do you speak to councillors if you say you do speak to councillors, particularly councillors who are not part of the ruling party in the council? Because, by and large, those councillors are excluded by the AG, in my experience. And I'm glad to hear you to say you do, so I'm hoping for a nice reply from you about how wrong I am. The other issue is materiality. I'm a bookkeeper, I'm not an auditor. But materiality is a screen very often that hides fraud. Simply because fraud's not material in terms of your determination as an auditor what is material and what isn't, to me seems to be a problem. And I've hit it a number of times with your department over the last 5 years and our various oversight in the Finance Committee, Selection Committee. I really would ask you to give me some comfort about materiality versus fraud. Okay, you've gone at pains to go through the clean audit definition, and as a bookkeeper, an accountant, I focus on unqualified audits. But I understand this clean audit thing was a political objective, and now you guys have kind of formulated what it means. Minister of Cooperative Government is now dead. It was the first one, I think, to use the term clean audit. But it's now become more formalized, and you've just explained it to us. And I've explained why I battle with the regulatory side of that. Okay, Mr. Chairman, the question of internal control systems being largely the problem. I absolutely agree with you. But how do you as an auditor deal with the political implications of those systems? Because very often they're not in place simply because, not so much because the skills aren't there, but there's no political will to make sure they're put into place. The accounting officers just simply lack the looseness and so on. And it's true to say that it's a systemic thing, that systems are put in place by people. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think first I just want to congratulate you on your presentation. I think even for me, to whom all of it is new, it has gone some way in making me understand some of these concepts, and I think I want to make a comment first. You can respond to the comment if you want, but I'll ask the question after the comment. And my comment is that I am beginning to understand for the first time today why a department would get a clean audit, but if you look at the performance side, I mean, it's just not happening. Like, correctional service would get a clean audit in a year when 80% of people who are sitting there are repeat offenders, which would clearly mean that they are not delivering on their mandate to rehabilitate. So you've made it clear to me how that has happened. Then it leads to my question that whoever decided, and I think it's nice to be new because you can ask any question without feeling stupid, whoever decided that your audit should not be thoroughgoing and identify fraud, as you said they don't, and, I mean, provide the assurance that service delivery is being achieved, because that service delivery is tied to money. And if you are doing a financial audit, clearly that should be thoroughgoing. And I'm asking this because this thing of clean audit has just become a license to kill. Departments think if I have a clean audit, then I'm doing okay. And it was almost like a pastor declaring somebody, you know, going to heaven. It doesn't matter what they do. They feel clean. The pastor has said so. So that's my worry. People just hide that I have a clean audit, so I'm doing okay. But we have clearly demonstrated today that that clean audit merely means that on the financials, there's no misrepresentation and the information is accurate. So then I want to ask, what's the purpose? And who stops you from, who's that major person that says, this is the only thing you can do, you know, as auditor general. You can't actually provide a thoroughgoing so that when the department says we've been audited and clean, we know it includes all the things that that is said it doesn't include.
Okay, thanks. Yes, comrade.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank the Deputy Auditor General for your presentation. I agree with my colleague that you have really helped some of us who are new. But, you know, I was asking myself a lot of questions as you were presenting. My first question is that I'm a very practical person, so I like making practical examples so that I can understand better. We have 9 provinces. We have plus minus 40 departments. I don't know how many municipalities are there. And you said in your presentation that I'm not sure if you're it was the correct number, or you are just talking about the key role players. You said that 3,900 and some people who are part of the Department of Auditor General. Just asking myself, with all the responsibilities that you have reported to this committee, that this is what the Auditor General is doing, I'm asking myself, do you have the capacity to go around all the municipalities, all the 9 provinces, all the departments, to make sure that at the end of the day, you achieve your main important function, which is to make sure that the public purse and the funds that are given to public, everybody who gets that reports accordingly? What then do you do every time you go to a particular municipality or a province or a department? They have the same problem financially. For instance, they had no findings, the outcomes were, you know, they had clean audits, or they didn't have, they had qualified with findings and all that. What happens when you find a particular department or a particular institution if they have the same problem throughout? I know that towards the end of your presentation, you were able to say we have a good story to tell in terms of some departments that have really pulled up their shops in terms of the problems that they have. But how do you make sure that you maintain that? Because at the end of the day, as public representatives as well, we have to make sure that people do what they're supposed to be doing in those offices. And you find, like my other colleague has said earlier on, that she was a counselor. I was also a counselor some time ago. And you find that a municipality decides that towards the end of their financial year, which will be June, as you said, there are deliverables that are really, that have to be rushed up, you know. And you find that those deliverables, it was not something that was on the budget. What then do you do, or do you have those kind of problems where you find a municipality or a council having a meeting and agreeing that, you know, we have to do A, B, C, D, and we have to do it now, but we didn't budget for that? What then happens? And what happens to those departments that are non-compliant? In other words, with all your responsibilities that you have told the committee, my question is that do you really have teeth to bite and make sure that you do what you're supposed to be doing at the end of the day? And congratulations, you are really doing a good work then.
Yes, comrades, then comrade boy.
Thank you very much, Chair. And let me thank also the Deputy AG for the presentation, because this is going to assist us in terms of our oversight, especially in the portfolio committees that we are also serving. The question that I want to ask relates to what the last speaker and the first speaker said in terms of the role that you are playing in the municipalities, especially in terms of taking councillors on board. Because to me, Chair, I don't know, is it going to be our role going forward to make sure that the MPECs in the municipalities are functional? Because to me, they even don't know their role as in the committees that are supposed to make oversight in terms of their work. So I think going forward, we must be able to make sure that we interact with them so that they can be able to assist different municipalities. And the other issue, you have said, the Deputy AG has said that they're also providing the oversight committees in Parliament with before in terms of you provide information to the oversight committees, but to me this is not assisting, because you only come once before the tablings of the annual report, so it doesn't give us clue in terms of the gaps that the department is having. So I also recommend that maybe twice, in just like you're doing with, I don't know, I'm not quite sure whether you have capacity, but you have indicated that you are meeting the executive four times and the departments and the other entities four times in a year. But I just wanted to recommend that if needs be, or if possible, if you do have capacity, maybe at least meet with the portfolio committee twice in a year, so that they can be able to, you can be able to highlight other issues that need to the attention of the portfolio committees. But to me now, this is not assisting, because normally you'll present even maybe 30 minutes before the actual presentation of the department, and to me this will not assist the department or the oversight committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Deputy. I think all of us are quite satisfied about the work that you are doing and quite happy. But the thing for me as a South African, it is to kiss the Mandela legacy away if we don't handle these matters quite properly and quite frank about each other. Because if we don't deal with this one, the instability that is growing in South Africa might just overwhelm all of us. And we should not be able to handle it at all. And at the center of all this thing, the next center of this matter, is about accountability and how do we handle the public purse. It's 20 years down the line now. So we are not dealing with the legacy of apartheid. We are dealing with issues of consequences, the decisions that we take. So for me, if you say, who really takes responsibility at the end of the day when you have come across mismanagement? Because you are saying yourself that it's no main issue of saying that there is no capacity. I agree with the first speaker that said that if the Auditor General seems to be more cooperative with these people on the ground when they don't produce the necessary information, are you not becoming part of the problem, you see? Are you not assisting into creating the disaster that we are beginning to feel ourselves that corruption won't be able to win away on its own, but it's becoming a problem in the reality of life, and ordinary people are beginning to feel it. If you deal with them kinds of problems, could have said, where was the Auditor General at the start of the process? Could have dealt with this thing, could have seen it, could have alerted the whole nation that there is a problem and could have done something. Then at the end of the product, today the whole country is like, what has gone wrong here? Where were the institutions at the correct time? And that's the question I'm asking myself, that where are you at the right time? I mean, when are you assisting us? And how do you help us to get consequences correct? You see, if you are going to have difficulty to get one department, I've expressed it to the chairperson yesterday to say that the ordinary people are quite weary. They are not listening to anymore to many of the politicians, whatever they can begin saying. And it has endangered South Africa, the instability that is growing. This is what all of us are looking for. No, we don't want. We want to enjoy South Africa. But if we don't handle the matters of the Auditor General in a more radical way to improve the lives of our people, this is going to become a bigger problem. So for me, what is really lacking, where all of us have to begin focusing, is that on the consequences. If a department doesn't become compliant, you can't find books. Are you saying to us that you are sending people down to go and help that department to find its own books, put them together, start writing up, taking the whole year on a department, on an individual who has been employed to do that particular responsibility? At least you are saying to me uncomfortably that vacancies are being filled, and are being filled with competent people. So South Africa is not faced anymore with problems of illiteracy or people not being there as accountants. So in the 20 years, what next do you think we should do as SCOPA? Because SCOPA must also begin here. So asking you that, do you have the teeth to bite as representatives of parliament? What must we do? Is it 2 times seeing us, talking to us, or where are the other solutions that you want us to have to be able to be more aggressive in our proceptivity? Because South Africa is faced with a disaster if we don't deal with these matters in a more aggressive manner and be sure that the public press is being protected. And that's the responsibilities of these members of parliament in SCOPA, protect the public press. Are you helping us, or are you going to footsie-footsie negotiating with people who mismanage and who lose his paperwork and come back and says, no, maybe there was a mistake, maybe there was an issue? How do you make us to feel comfortable that the work that they're doing doesn't put you or doesn't remove your neutrality into helping us to be aggressive, into getting a proper analysis of where the disaster lies?
Well, thank you. Maybe let's take the... Oh, no. Okay. Maybe let's respond to the questions that will come for the second round of questions.
Alright, thank you very much for the questions that went round, as well as the compliments from the honourable members. I'll take each question in turn. The one about our regularity processes and how we manage our independent threat that arises when we engage with auditors in terms of assisting. All of our auditors are trained around the ethical principles associated with our work as independent auditors, and we are very clear about where our independence begins and ends. The reality is, if we are to add value to the process of building institutional capacity for government, we've got to use our insights and provide value-adding recommendations and provide support. But we don't ever put ourselves in a position where we audit our work. Managers must manage. Our work is very clear, so we don't ever cross that bar. And I've not ever come across a situation where one of our people has had that dilemma. We're quite clear about where it begins and ends. Fortunately, we're all trained in that area, so it's a very central part of auditing 101, and we instill it in all that we do. So I wouldn't worry about that. The matter about the performance objectives, again, it's about our role in formulating the type of recommendations that are clear for action. So it's one thing for us to audit Office of the Premier and then audit a municipality, then audit COPTA, but never bring those insights together. I think the country will be poorer for it. So in auditing COPTA, we know what it is we're auditing, but there are things that we believe a COPTA must do, a COPTA department, whether in the province or even nationally, must do to support
the process of building capacity in the other spheres. So we're able to then say, hey, this is where we see the gap, because we have access to both sides of the coin. And I think it's really a process of adding value into the system. We can't do the work for them. We can't change performance objectives. We can't tell oversight what sort of strike plan to approve or not approve. We can only sit with you and tell you what we've seen. 2 years ago, about 18 months ago, we started a process of pre-auditing the performance objectives of departments, because we understood that at the time that oversight approves their budget, they are best equipped if they have had our insight on the quality of the performance objective. So we'll tell you whether or not we think it's smart principles that we applied. We'll tell you whether or not we think that there may be a gap. We can't take ownership for the information. It's manager's information to oversight. It's oversight that must then approve. But we can time our input in a way that adds value. Again, the role is very clear. We audit, we report, and we share in the most timely manner, in the most effective manner we can. But at the end of the day, the actions must be taken by those who are given those responsibilities. The one about irregular expenditure, whether or not ACM regulations are onerous or particularly stringent, I'm not convinced of that, I have to be honest. But fortunately, the accounting general's here. So he can make that assessment and indicate to you what his plans are in that regard. But you would have noticed when we issued our report on municipalities about 2.5 weeks ago, we were quite specific in saying this number that you see as irregular expenditure doesn't mean that there's been fraud in all of it, doesn't mean that goods and services were not acquired. It just is an indicator that not all laws were compliant with, which opens up the risk around value for money. It doesn't mean that risk manifested or that it was taken advantage of, but it is exposure that we best close through strengthening internal controls so that those who want to do wrong don't have too much of an opportunity to do so. So our role, again, is to report in a manner that helps those that are responsible for governing and those that are responsible for overseeing government know what it is they've got to fix. And that's the journey that we've consistently been on, and we'll continue in that thing. Very clear about our independence, very clear about what it means for our capacity, but our aspiration is to be an independent audit office that provides relevant and useful information for those that are responsible for running government. The area of these three things that we look at, financial information, performance information, compliance, that's a requirement of the Public Audit Act. And that is a responsibility that we have. And we remain convinced that it is appropriate for us to look at those three things, again, regardless of what it's called. Do we talk to councils? Yes, we table our audit report in councils, and we talk to councils. We don't respond necessarily to individual councillors, much in the same way that when we interact with this committee, we prefer to interact not with individual members, but through the chairman, because we must support the committee. So it might well be that Mr. Wheeler chose not to engage with an individual counselor, but indeed Mr. Wheeler does engage with counsel. I hope that helps. The materiality issues, we look at materiality from an audit point of view, an auditor point of view, so we can't look at every single thing. But we remain convinced that the methods we use do indicate areas of risk that we can highlight to managers, highlight to oversight, who must then act and investigate further. And I think if the things we reported upon were investigated and followed through, you would find that there's not much that is missed because of materiality numbers. The accounting officer role around needing to instill and maintain proper financial records, proper processes of internal control, is something I think we all need to focus on, and maybe that should be the focus of this committee. The BFMA is really clear on it, as is the MFMA. I'm the accounting officer of the Office of the Auditor General, and it is my responsibility, regardless of what else I might think, but it is my legal responsibility to ensure that I maintain proper internal controls. It is my responsibility to ensure that my systems are adequate to present proper financial information and to safeguard the assets with which I've been entrusted. And I think if we were able to highlight those responsibilities to accounting officers, we would have won a major, major battle, because maybe it is that people don't understand that responsibility. People in those seats and people around them. And we should emphasize that point and monitor the effective implementation of what is an important piece of legislation. Honorable Chabalala, you talk about correctional services. Again, what I need to highlight is we are an independent auditor with a very clear mandate, and the things we report upon we think remain useful for you to understand where the risks are, you from an oversight point of view. At the end of the day, the role of managers, the role of the minister in this case, and the role of oversight are very clear. And if everybody's playing their role, we will be fine. The challenge is that it means somewhere somebody's not doing that which they're supposed to do. And do we have teeth to do what we're supposed to do? I'm quite comfortable that we have enough to do what we need to do to remain a relevant, independent audit institution for this country. We've just got to be clear about where the weaknesses in the system might be. I hope that helps. We can engage more on the detail of that if you'd like offline. There was a question, I think, on Okuno about the size of the office. We do our audits, 75% of our audit work, we conduct maybe 1,000 audits in a year. 75% of the work we do ourselves. The other 25% we outsource to private audit firms. And it's a practice we've been engaged on for a very long time now. It helps us manage the very tight reporting deadlines that we have in terms of the Act. But it also achieves a very important objective, that of driving cross-pollination between us as the Supreme Public Auditor and our private sector auditors, who are effectively our professional colleagues, so that their knowledge of the public sector increases, that and their ability to service the public sector when they come and consult and do other things is just enriched. So we're quite keen to maintain that balance from a capacity point of view. Is it adequate? We think it is. And yeah, I'd be happy to be convinced otherwise. The role of SCOPA in supporting impacts, I think that's something maybe we can talk about tomorrow when we think about where things are headed. Our appreciation for the establishment of impacts we have reported upon, I think it's important that we note that success. Our concern is that the effectiveness of impacts is being compromised because not all councillors are clear on why impacts are important. And it's much like internal audit. I made the point earlier on that we've got to ensure that we strengthen internal audit capabilities in government. But I know as an accounting officer, if I don't take my internal auditor seriously, I will not get value from them. I must ensure that they are appropriately located. They have direct access not only to me but to my oversight. They have access to all the resources that they require to execute their work. And of course they'll show up things that are weaknesses in my environment that I must go and improve. But I'm basically responsible for ensuring that they are able to do their work. Unless accounting officers and executive officers understand the importance of internal audit, will continue to have less value from that assurance provider, similar to impacts. Unless councillors understand why impacts are important, we're going to have challenges around the ability of those committees and the effectiveness of those committees. So maybe in thinking about how Parliament could support the process of strengthening impacts, we should have a look at that around capacity for councils generally. The request for us to engage more proactively or more frequently with portfolio committees is well noted, Honorable Speaker. I think that it's something that we stand ready to do. Indeed, we are using this period of induction to drive a message about scheduling for committees so that at least we do have enough opportunity to work with portfolio committees as and when relevant. But indeed, we stand ready to do that. The independence of the Office of the Auditor General is something that is enshrined in the Constitution. It's something that all of us as South Africans must protect, even those of us who work for that office. There was a question about how does the Office of the AG help when you've got projects that are particularly problematic like the Nkandla one. I'll respond this way. We audit the Department of Public Works every single year. And every single year, we issue an audit report associated with the activities and the reporting of that department. The question to be asked is, what happened to those reports? What is it in those reports that could have assisted in flagging the issues that manifested in an example such as Nkandla? And I think if you look at those audit reports, you'll be able to track where the weaknesses arose and the opportunities arose. And we've got to ask the question of what happened in those reports? How did the Portfolio Committee of Public Works deal with it? How did SCOPA deal with it? And what has happened to the resolutions that might have arisen from those committees? At this point, I remain ever confident that we executed our responsibility adequately. I hope I've answered everything, Chair.
Thank you. I only have two hands. Okay. Ray, you want to make a follow-up? Okay, you will be the fourth.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. First of all, let me apologize for my late coming and thank the Auditor General's Office for their presentation. Very informative. So, and in my experience from a municipal level, I know that the Auditor General's Office is very effective and very committed. That is what I have found. The challenge is what I have discovered thus far is that, first of all, there seems to be a misinterpretation about regulations, about how the Auditor General's interprets and how those at council level interpret. And I'll give you one good example. The way the Auditor General will interpret MFMA 1163 and the way municipality will, for their own convenience, interpret it is one of those things that creates a very, very serious problem. But I must tell you that the problem that I have is with the municipal public at the lower level. Number one, I don't think they know what their mandate is. And if you speak to them at any level, at any municipality, nobody knows exactly what the mandate is and to what extent they can go. While they will investigate, they will interrogate, they will find out, and that's where it stops. It goes no further. One of the problems I found is that Auditor General's findings are there. At the local level, the parties that are responding to your findings quite often come to us at MPAC and say, but hold on, this has not come to us. It's gone to another department. They have responded. We don't feel it's in the problem is with the Auditor General. Very often we've heard that. The problem lies with the Auditor General. In terms of the irregular expenditure, I must warn that irregular expenditure, why quite often I hear one saying that there's no reason to believe that there was no value for money and things like that. But I think one needs to go a little bit deeper into irregular expenditure. Because if you take some of the municipalities, one particular had 1.3 billion in 1 year, irregular expenditure. Now, the question is, why did that irregular expenditure occur? You know the processes and the procedures. You know everything that you needed to follow. Okay? But that irregular expenditure is still okay. Now, what is happening right now is, people are continuing with irregular expenditure, regularizing it before it comes to Auditor General. So they believe now we are correcting it because we are doing it before the general has now picked it up. But now let me tell you, in terms of that irregular expenditure, you would find in that irregular expenditure there could be fraud, there could be corruption, there could be maladministration, nothing that the AG will pick up at all. Because the AG's reports and findings come totally as a result of the documentation or reports provided by municipalities or the different entities. That is the difficulty that I have. And I'll give you an example. A contract of 18 million cannot be allocated because you do not qualify for a particular grading. So what do? You divide it into 6-3 million rand contracts so that a particular contract can get that. Now, AG is not going to pick up that. That is why I believe that the term clean audit should be removed completely from the vocabulary of Auditor General. We can call unqualified audit, but not clean audit, because there's a hell of a lot more into it. Because the impression when you say clean audit is everything is hunky-dory, absolutely perfect at that level. And really it is not. But I will also agree with colleagues, there's a difficulty when you investigate, you identify, and you want to take the corrective measures, and you're not allowed to do that. You stop right there. And now I want to know from the AG's office, what role can you play in ensuring that when you identify challenges, you identify corruption, you identify non-compliance, that there's going to be consequences, or what recommendations can the AG's office make so that there could be changes in legislation to cover, number one, those loopholes that are being used, number two, to ensure that people are now accountable for whatever they have mismanaged or whatever it is. Those are some of the serious challenges that I find that we seem to be experiencing, especially at the level. Finally, when you give us your findings, and the other parties come to MPAC and they respond, that's where it stops. Goes no further. Absolutely no further. There's no comeback even from the AG's office to say, but hold on, we are still not satisfied because the responses that you are giving are not good enough. We need to go further and investigate and interrogate it and see where it is. And my last point, although I said finally, is that when you assist people, and like you've assisted them to bring it up the level of entities that might have received unqualified, there is a danger there. Because number one, it tells me that you either don't have the capacity and that you have to do their job, but you are supposed to be independent. Then it means what should happen is that you should recommend that people that are there should be more capacitated to be able to comply so that it makes it easier for you to be independent, so that we would be able to then identify the serious challenges that are faced by those different entities. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Chairperson. Madam DAG, thank you very much for your presentation. The two questions that I would like to raise is, well, the first one pertains to the situation that we have in South Africa, is that many, over 54% of our entities are achieving the qualified with findings audit results. And it's quite clear from your presentation that the issue we have is that there's a culture of, frankly, reckless mediocrity, and not a culture of excellence, not a culture of getting all three steps right in terms of achieving the best outcomes. And like my colleagues here, I started my career as a counsellor, and in that sphere I was often party to, unfortunately, many meetings where we had to regularise irregular expenditure, which is catered for in terms of certain legislation. So the question I put to you is that, is that particular legislation which allows us to wipe the slate clean every year, especially on the municipal level, and regularise income? I understand from an accounting point of view that you need to move the books along, you can't drag it along year after year, but is that culture
is that good intention of that particular legislative prescription has not led to a phenomenon of, well, you know what, we can make mistakes during the year. The AG will come and give a, they'll frown at us and tell us we haven't done things right. But you know, at the end of the day, we can just regularize it. And the municipality where I come from, the regularization amounts were often in excess of 500, 600, 700 million. So you weren't talking about small amounts of money, certainly substantial material amounts. So that is my first question to you. Can you not look at strengthening or tightening up those provisions of the legislation that take away the instant coffee phenomenon we seem to have in some of our entities, that you can just make it right, especially when there's no trigger that leads to SIU investigations, etc., etc., and at the end of the day, people losing their jobs or possibly going to jail. The other question I have is that it's quite clear from past audit general reports and from the most recent ones is that one of our major issues that we have in South African entities is the issue of capacity. And it's obviously a major challenge because we need to upskill our society to get to the point where we all have the capacity to run the various functions. The problem with capacity is that capacity enables you to fix things, but it also enables you to know when something's wrong. And if you don't know that there's something wrong, then you're in a fool's paradise. Now, my question is, as we see year after year, the AG is saying that there's clearly a lack of capacity to prepare the books, to get everything right for the audits, etc., etc., etc. But there's a lack of that capacity, there's too much use of consultants, and there's a lack of political leadership to make sure it all happens. My question is, should we not think about putting in legislation, or in whatever mechanism we can use, giving the AG, or maybe the Accountant General's office, an oversight role in the appointment of financial officers? So when a city manager has to appoint a financial manager in a particular, financial officer in a particular sphere, that somebody from the AG's office or the accountant general's office or whatever competent authority that is competent and has the capacity is involved in that process to make sure that that person who gets appointed in fact does have the capacity to do the job, does know how to do it, and does have the moral fortitude to push through and make the unpopular decisions, etc., etc., to make sure that we cut down on the problem that we have of capacity and the annual complaints that we have that we just don't have the right people on the ground to get it done. So those are my questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. I will also harp on the salutations, although I arrived a bit late and I apologize for that, Chair. That the report, the presentation has been very informative and will really help. I just have two short questions, and maybe they just follow up some questions that have already been asked. The first one is, on the issue of the regressions that you pointed to, and subsequently you went on to a slide about the corrective action or the interventions which then put some of the ODGs in the green. I'm just trying to look at the sustainability of the interventions that you are making, and or whether they are year-on-year or continuous, because you'll then find a situation where you are continuously making interventions simply because you have arrived, and when you have left, they go back to square one. So, just maybe a detailed information on the extent of those interventions and the corrective action and their sustainability. Secondly, is the use of consultants, the extent of use of consultants, and I've got no problem with consultants. I want them to think that they've been put out of business, but I think that we must also, you know, sort of zoom in a little bit on them. Now, my question is, in the preparation of the financial statements in particular, what is the extent of the use of consultants actually preparing these statements for the auditees? Because then, if they've been done by somebody from us, they'll give us a full good syndrome to say, well, we've got a good story to tell, only to find that it is not the competence and the capacity of the auditee, rather it is the competence and capacity of an outsider. So, you know, how do you view that, and what regulations can we put in place to safeguard against that false feeling that auditees are actually performing, only to find that the statements are not actually being prepared by the relevant auditee? Thank you very much, Chair.
You see, we have dealt with the area of really like thanking you. But you see, I always feel that you should not move from a defensive position. We should sometimes, South Africans, talk from an honest point of view. You see, if we don't do that, we might just say the Auditor General is doing a good job and thank you very much, and we all look around and walk away from it. And when it's faced with witnesses, we start saying South Africa is collapsing, and when it collapses, all of us get the blame. You see, South Africa is not so uniform. There's urban, rural, you see. And from experience, they don't exercise the same, even in running of their own administrations. Now, from the auditor's point of view, it seems to see the uniformity. Everything is equal. I don't find it very convincing for me, you see, to want to look through that eye as a politician, that is this thing just running smooth? Where is the weakness? I mean, is it that as a politician I see things differently from what you are seeing? I know you have read the Constitution, you have read the auditor's role, we all understand it. But for us in 20 years, it's the practicalities. You see, you are making a good, assertion. The inside story, you see. We are interested in that inside story, you see. Because that inside story deals with the internal arrangement of the witnesses that make sure that managers are not able to keep records of the work that they are doing. And that's why members are feeling that this thing of clean auditing is a little bit misleading, you see. Because half the time, if I go to Mthatha and I go to a council in Mthatha, I don't even have to look for the books. Because when I look at the structure that where Mthatha's offices are of the council, it's a good example of that. There's no work taking place there. The files are piled. I can see what is happening here. And when the Auditor General gave a report, it sounds very glorious, sunshine, and I must be happy. But there's an ordinary fellow who's not in the auditor, but who's an accountant who walks around there, who's got a totally different impression that the council is not there for me. You see, I'll tell you, in the defense force where we sat with a problem after we were fighting with Mr. Wheeler over a problem that took place in the 80s of Air Force people that have been inside there who've not been audited. You know, some of these things happen. And this is what we want to hear, so that if we want us to be able to help SCOPA to deliver in the mandate and assist, I think there's a level where you should, as Auditor General, engage SCOPA totally differently than the other committees about the inside story. So that if you want us to leave the bar, we have to be totally different, because we need to know what are the weaknesses. See the chair there? Says to me, Kimberley is growing, the Kimberley Hospital. It's becoming a phenomenal problem. It's growing as a problem. It's going to billions. You see? And the SCOPA has been there, you know, like tourists wearing titles. They've been visiting that hospital. They want to go back again. But what are we looking for? Where are the weaknesses of that problem? You see? From where we sit as the ruling party, we need to be aggressive about these things. We need to be very outspoken about them. We need to deal with them, because if there's no consequences when people don't comply with the law, you can't not comply with the law in 20 years' time. What else are you up to when you don't want to comply with the law? You see? And the Auditor General should be able to sideline those issues and say, politicians deal with this matter. Let us hear the particular element, you see. Let's hear what is important. We don't want to go and run your books and sit around and be auditors. We don't want to be auditors. But what they say, if there's issues of regulation and they are really stifling progress and they are creating problems, bring that to the attention of the politicians and let them be able to debate it and amongst them and find solution and be able to make, if it's necessary, legislation or a constitutional amendment. If you don't hear those things, what the Auditor General is saying to us, everything is hunky-dory. But when the report comes out, things that go to the public, I think that there's a lot of critical points that we are not addressing as politicians. And it brings us down, it drags us down as a country, it gives you the image of the country, it gives you the image of all of us. As we listen to you, people are saying that, what are these politicians listening to when they can't be able to assist the Auditor General to be able to deal with issues that are confronting them? But unless they sound frank and honest to say to us, here, these are the administrative challenges that you couldn't be able to tell me. Is there such a scenario? Would you be able to tell us one day, what is this inside that you say? Because I know, administrations change. And I'll tell you now, I mean, the executive has gone more wider. And the responsibility with COPPA is going to go more wider. And you can't, when you come back after next year, you'll be telling us the same story, no, the constitution and the auditors, my responsibilities are very nice. That's a good statement. But the practicalities that we are concerned about is that how does the fiscal step spend it around these areas of work? And how do we keep our fingers on? But our responsibility as COPPA is to be able to make sure that the public purse is not being spoiled. And this is where South Africa is going to go down. And this is where you want us to be able to give you that nerve and give us guidance on, so that we could be able here as public representatives find the relevance of COPPA and find a way of dealing with the public purse in a more aggressive manner to be able to take South Africa out of the perceptions that it's a corrupt country. We would want to deal with that. If you could help us, I think we'd be very glad from the ruling party to be able to give you all the support that you are looking for. But if you hide it, or you keep, because this is why we worry about this closeness that the members raised, that when you too close the scope and assist them when they can't find their records, you must understand that you're taking somebody's responsibility and that person is not able to say that he's doing his work. And also it worries us that how close does the Auditor General add to those type of problems. You see, I know, I can tell you out of many years of being in Parliament, which we are dealing with the Defence Force, they remain very close, you see. And sometimes when you ask questions, you get worried that it seems as if the Auditor General moves the department more than the people are in the department. And these are the concerns that one would have out of experience and would be like, what do we do, where do we draw the line? And how do you assist us in SCOPPA to be able to have that capacity of being able to assist in intervention, in dealing with that hospital in Kimberley rather than becoming tourists year by year after year to go and look how much money is now being blown and how much money is going to go up, and nothing is going to happen at the end of the day. We need to be able to arrest at a point where all of us are saying enough is enough and there should be consequences in what we are dealing with.
But, thank you, comrade. I think before the Deputy Auditor General responds, I just want to stress, comrade, that remember at the beginning I indicated that today's session is very different in the sense that the two stakeholders here who are always there to assist us with the additional information are engaging with us today to lay the basis and the foundation to say what work do they do and how are they of help to us as a committee. And remember, the Auditor General provides information to both the executive and to Parliament. It's up to us to decide what do we do with that information. Oversight is the responsibility of Parliament, not the Auditor General. I think that the Auditor General can do all that the Auditor General can do is to say, here is the information, this is what we found. And I'm sure as comrades will note going forward,
what we have here is the Auditor General will always come and give us additional information that should assist us when we engage the departments. And I thought the question from Comrade Chabalala was, what limits you from auditing everything? I thought that was the thrust of the question. Why don't you audit everything? So that when you say this is a clean audit, if we use that term, we'll know that from A to Z, everything is fine. And the issue of, and I'm sure that will also be linked to issues of materiality. Because materiality is determined by the budget. If you go to Transnet, the materiality level is above 500 million. So, and for you it's fine, but for us it's oversight. What may we need to do beyond what the Auditor General reports to be able to get to the bottom of some of these issues? And the issue around private audit firms, you give them work, but are there guidelines and standards that you set for them? Because initially you indicated the difference between their approach and your approach. So if they apply private sector standards to public accounting, vis-a-vis what you do, it means that their reports will basically not be very useful. And our experience here has been that reports by private firms have not been very, very helpful in terms of the quality of information presented to assist oversight. The other issue might be my own interest. If you look at the Department of Higher Education, there's a lot of money going to universities. I'm not sure whether you actually audit these institutions, because they are public institutions. Money going to these institutions. We see the minister trying to intervene, and there are court cases about who are independent, don't touch us. But from some of the things we glean, you realize that things are really, really bad. It's public money. I'm not sure where they stand and where they stand. Lastly, just to emphasize that comrades, a department or entities have internal audit units as well as audit committees who actually do the work that the Auditor General does before the Auditor General comes. So the things that the Auditor General finds are things that internal audits will have found and reported to management that these are the weaknesses. And it's up to management to respond to those things. But the fact that the Auditor General comes and still finds them, it means that you either have weak internal audits and audit committees, or management simply ignores recommendations from those structures. Yeah, let me hand over to the Auditor General. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for those questions. Private sector firms that do work on our behalf do that work with oversight from us. We issue an audit directive which specifies what standard of work, what extent of work must be conducted when they do work in the public sector. So if there are concerns about the extent of reporting that is available to you, I think it's something we should tackle on a case-by-case basis, but we do issue those standards, and they are similar to what we would apply. The question about why don't we audit everything, Chair, I'll go back to your last comment about there being an internal audit function that is there to investigate everything and look at everything because they are there throughout the year. And they are supposed to work under the guidance of the audit committee, who themselves are there during the course of the year. Our audit process is not one designed to look at everything. And I fear that if we try to look at everything, not only would we be taking time and taking on the role of other players, managers, internal audit committee, but we would never finish. We would be spending time doing all that other players are supposed to be doing, and it may even tarnish our ability to operate and be seen to be operating independently of all of those other structures. So I'd like to say maybe we serve a different purpose. It's not one designed to look at everything. It's to highlight those things that may be risks and need to be investigated further by other people as well. There was a question about the effectiveness and capacity of impact. And I think the real answer lies in the capacity of counselors to understand what role impacts must play. Because if they understand that role, they will ensure that people who are appropriate are appointed to impact. Impacts are adequately resourced and are given space to do that which they must do. So I think the key focus must be on equipping counselors to do what they are tasked to do with excellence, to understand the legislation, to be able to apply it, to understand their responsibilities and rights granted to them in law. Our analysis is that element is lacking. So we put in place a whole lot of legislation, be it the MFMA, and people just don't abide by it, and in large part because they're not sure on how to implement it. No doubt there are those who choose not to apply laws and regulations, but in large part it's because people are unaware of their responsibilities and are ill-equipped to execute on those responsibilities. We published a book of consequences where we try to summarize, as an audit office, we summarize the responsibilities that relate to every player: internal audit, accounting officer, CFO, counsel, etc., and link it to when you found this transgression, these are the steps you follow. And perhaps we need to build on that in terms of making sure that people are using that insight. But I'm sure there are other things we need to be doing to ensure that the system is adequately prepared. I'll just maybe answer on 2-3 other matters. The process of regularizing irregular expenditure, the process of corrections, much of that is really about discipline. If you look at this slide, the one about the outcome if corrections are made, those people who are able to effect those corrections once we pointed them out really should have just prepared the right set of financials before we got there. So we think to a large extent, not in all cases, but to a large extent, it's just about having the disciplines in place, making sure things are done at the appropriate standard and they are reviewed and monitored at the appropriate time. And until we sort out these matters about what the culture is, whether people, when they do wrong, there are consequences. When they perform badly, there are consequences. When they perform well, there are good consequences. Until we get a culture where there's no tolerance for poor performance, no tolerance for transgression, we're going to keep trying to regulate for behavior. And it's really about just setting the tone and applying consequences when things go wrong so that people understand that we will not tolerate ill discipline and deviations from what we deemed to be the norm, the expected norm. And I hope that answers even the question about the role we play when we give people opportunity to correct. I don't think that the Office of the Auditor General should be playing a role in appointing accounting officers or CFOs. We have played a role for someone else in the system, one of the other coordinating departments, and perhaps my colleague behind me might think about it, but I don't think that's appropriate for us, because remember, we've got to remain independent. We seem to be and genuinely be independent, so that when we engage with you, we can do so with you understanding that we provide independent insight and provide it as boldly and in specific terms as and when required. You can imagine our general report or even a conversation like this is general, so it's hard to talk about a particular auditee in specific detail that you might be looking for. The use of consultants in preparing financial statements, that continues. We see it in many departments, but predominantly in municipalities, and we've been worried about this for a long time. We've looked at it in more detail and arrived at the conclusion that the 700 million rand that was spent by municipalities in preparing their financials for the year ended June 2013 in large part did not realize significant gain because there was a lack of documentation. We actually asked our auditors to go and look and said, when you see this, when the audit outcomes, when the financial reports are still not right and there's been a professional accountant appointed, tell us what's happening. Why is it? And we found that in at least half of those cases, there was a lack of documentation. And the answer to this lies in ensuring that all of us, professional accountants, as well as those responsible for running the affairs of government, the CFO, the municipal manager, the mayor, drive and display appropriate levels of ethical conduct all the time. And that's where the key is. It's really about changing the culture within the public service. Because that CFO at the time that he or she appoints a consultant to put together a set of financials when there's no supporting documentation to support that trial balance that is presented to the professional, that's a problem. And I think it starts about discipline, culture, ethical conduct. And I think until that issue of discipline and ethical conduct is resolved, these corrections will continue, which, yes, I agree, are unsustainable. Chair, you asked about the universities. We've been in a journey with the Department of Higher Education and Training to take on the audit of the universities and the FET colleges. The focus was initially on the FET colleges, and we've taken on board some, but we're auditing ourselves now. And we're working on the universities as well, so that at least we can get them into the fold. The initial thrust was to get them having being audited and reporting in a manner that we would expect. So we're starting to make some gains there, just starting them.
Thank you very much, Deputy Auditor General. Comrades, can we have a 3 minutes break before Mr. Treasurer? Thank you, Deputy Auditor General. I'm sure comrades will still engage with the Auditor General's office, as it is always with us. I'm sure some of the things will be clear as we move on. But thank you very much. Can we have a 3 minutes break?